His one true secret was that he was made nervous by retirement. Thought being over the hill was a bit unbecoming. Yet that evening Charlie had a kind of epiphany that he thought marked a watershed in his life. Going down to the cab, on Bex's orders, so that she could flounce and bounce herself up a little and look nice for him, he nodded to the cabbie, who muttered, "Evening, Chief," as Gauntlet slung himself into the back to get out of the cold. Said his wife would be down in a minute. His wife, yes. He did not have to repeat it for the cameras. They're never ready on time, are they? Always late when you'd made reservations, had a schedule, had to get her to the church on time. Never could stick to the programme, letter second. The cabbie was loquacious, and Gauntlet was in a schmoozing mood. So, smiling stupidly, Charlie suddenly realised that he'd done the trick he'd been trying to accomplish since the demise of the Cold War. He had accepted it as being over. In a couple of stray seconds, he'd managed to embrace the truth that he had retired and need not march to the beat of the secret silent drum anymore. His smile broadened, and he made a slight movement, the stirring of a cat against a leg. His eyes closed for a few seconds, as he luxuriated in the knowledge that never again he had to walk the line and tread with care. It was over for him. He could pack up his troubles in his old kit bag and grin. The only danger he had to face now was a rogue car, plane, or train, or even the attack of a mutant killer virus. No more the writing on the wall. Well, except for any ghosts that might just come a-haunting from the freezing iceberg years. And that wasn't all that likely, was it? So, Bex appeared, looking wonderful, and even statuesque in her big black coat with the turned-up collar, that reached almost around her whole head. She pushed her shoulder next to his, and moved in a snuggling motion against him, as the cabbie tried to set a brisk pace under the impossible conditions of the early evening London traffic. Charlie closed his eyes again, sentimental old fool that he was. When he'd first met Bex Oleska, he'd thought her short of stature, but that was only a trick of the light, for she stood around 5'7" in her stocking feet, and sometimes she was clever enough to appear only 5'2", while other times she was 6 feet tall. And then there was the hair, always different, sometimes long and dark, then short and honey. After that, all the shades in between. Charlie said that if she could have grown a beard, she'd have done it in months that didn't have an R in them. Her real colour, he knew from his unique vantage point, was near black. And as Alfred Hitchcock had said to Tippi Hedren when they were making The Birds, "Grab at it if one flies up your skirt, 'cause a bird in the hand." In truth, Rebecca Oleska, Bex to her friends, copper of this parish, was a rangy young woman with a hint of the athlete in her long, up-to-her-armpits legs, and a definite way of moving her shoulders that would be enough to frighten off anyone planning larceny or terrorism had they seen her first. Charlie loved the way she walked, loped, really, long, soft strides that whispered if she wore a skirt. He often said to her that her thighs were like silk when they touched one another.
"That's not original, Bex, but it's true."
And Bex? How did Bex view life from the sharp end of being just married? Never ever thought you'd say it, did you, Bex? Never thought you'd ever say you loved someone just like you love Charlie? Love him to pieces. Love the scent of him, the maleness and the same cologne he always used, the sweet-smelling, successful wonder of him. God, you can almost even smell his smile, just as the old song says, like the sun after rain. You can't put it into words. It's difficult, but you never had the talent with words, even like the tickle of his moustache. Bex Oleska, Wonder Woman of the anti-terrorist branch, sat in the back of the taxi, lifted her head from his shoulder, peeked at him, saw the contented smile on his face, and put her head back in its nestling place, giving a sigh like a lovelorn loon, and trying to put it all into words.
"Take a card," Charlie whispered. "Any card."
When When she'd first met him, 100 years ago, she'd not even particularly liked him. It hit her hours later, all of a sudden, knocked her for six. With his medium height and broad shoulders, very neat the way he walked and moved. He could never be described as handsome, with his deceptively open face that had been the downfall of many an unwary man and woman in the witness box, or that safe house in which the firm conducted close questioning, which is another word for interrogation. Once she got over that, she was in love with him. She jotted down several little mental notes, just to remember how he made her feel, like dancing down the street and throwing a bit of sunlight at her. He could come into a room and, pow, reach up, grab a handful of sunlight and hurl it at her so that the whole room took on new dimensions. Bloody hell, Bex, is that you talking? What would all her liberated militant feminist friends say? More to the point, what would her mother say if she could listen in to the stream going sliding on the thin ice of her daughter's conscious waking thoughts? Rebecca Oleska, I've never heard anything like that in all my born days, she would have said. Becca, you're a wanton young woman. Say it, Mum, tell me I'm a slut, 'cause all I want is for this lovely overgrown schoolboy of a man to wrap himself round me and pull me close, hold me forever. Bex was amazed to feel like this, because it really wasn't her. Nobody she worked with could possibly recognize her if they listened to this soppy cow. So it was that they sat with shoulders touching and the ring on her left hand seeming to be out of place and very heavy, as they let Wagner's opera rage and rumble over them. They saw and heard the Dutchman's ship enter Sandrika Bay with its blood-red sails, and the curse that is on the captain, who must sail the oceans until the day of judgment, unless he can find a woman who will be faithful only to him. A tall order, Beck thought, but one she could find easy enough if the man happened to be Gauntlet, who was himself thinking the same thing in reverse. But he did not let it show, at least until the interval, when he whispered, "See, you've to stay faithful to me, Bex. Otherwise I'd turn into a lobster." "You're a lobster already." She held on to his arm, and they struggled into the bar, grabbing the drinks they had already ordered, Perrier water for her, and a black coffee for her husband. Two sips in, and one comment on the tenor, before Charlie heard the laugh, recognized it, and felt the short hairs rise on the back of his neck. She saw him prick up his ears like a meerkat. She doubted if anyone else would notice, but prided herself on her ability to spot the changes in him. Only the tiniest of movements, but to her it was a stretching of the neck, tilting of the head, with the grey eyes set absolutely still. "What's going on?" she all but whispered.
"Ghost. Tell you later."
Another sip of the coffee, and a turning of the head in the direction of the laugh. He was right, 120%. And what the hell was Kit Palfrey doing here in London, of all places? They'd just about run him out of this city on a rail. But that was 30 years ago. 30 years and counting. Run him out, and then suffered the embarrassment of hearing him tell the world from his new home in Moscow that he was a traitor to his country and proud of it. Kit Palfrey, spy about town, more dangerous than any of them, part of the so-called Cambridge Ring. Charlie himself had reason to remember Kit, for it was Kit who had... what the hell. It was over and done with now, long gone, ancient history. And he would have to dredge his mind for the details. Just a bad dream. Old Kit Palfrey. And he looked pretty old now. 65? 70? Well, he would, wouldn't he? It had happened 30 years ago. Doesn't time fly when you've been keeping secrets? They used to say, the press used to say, and people in the Foreign Service also, that he looked like the film actor James Stewart. He certainly had that tall, thin, gangly frame and a voice that drawled and seemed to splutter out what he wanted to say, reaching for words that were just over the skyline. But there the resemblance ended, as far as Charlie was concerned. The face was more like that of a different actor, more square, stocky, angular. Claude Rains, possibly, yes. Claude Rains' head on James Stewart's body.